Okay, before we get too far into today's episode, I got some exciting news to share. We've officially launched a website where you'll discover a hub for all things Star Wars. From the latest news to exclusive merchandise. And here's the best part. For just $5 a month, you can join our membership program to access all of our episodes completely ad-free and all new episodes a few days earlier. But that's not all. Our members enjoy a treasure trove of content that'll never hit the airwaves of this show, including special episodes, full audio comics, and books. So if you're craving extra content or eager to listen to an episode early without interruptions or simply just want to grab a Sway t-shirt, head over to www.swaypodcast.com. That's SWAAPODCAST.com. Don't miss out on your chance for exclusive content and so much more.
What grill do you have?
You're now tuned in to the Talk to Sway. So just sit back and ready to play. Let me take your thoughts far, far away. Now let's hear what Darth Vader has to say.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hey there, Space Saga enthusiasts. Kyle here, ready to ramp up the excitement with Episode 2 of Into the Dark. And you are now tuned into the Interstellar Escapades of Star Wars Audio Archives. Today, I take us deeper into the High Republic. And trust me, this ride's about to go hyper. Think of this as the sequel that doubles down on everything that you loved about Episode 1. More twists and secrets so big that they would make a black hole look like a pothole. So are you ready to jump to light speed? Episode 2 is about to blast off, leaving tales of stardust in its wake. Let's light up our sabers and dive into the adventure. Are you ready? Then let's go.
The makeshift bunks aboard the vessel weren't luxurious, but then again, neither were the Padawan's quarters in the temple. Reef noted the small cot, the thin partitions, and the bare-bones fresher without complaint. Nor could he complain about the vessel itself. All right, its crew was eccentric, and maybe it was more ramshackle than the average ship that landed on Coruscant. However, the engines hummed along easily. The internal temperature remained within a range comfortable for humans and most near-human species. The Jedi had plenty of room to relax, either in solitude or with others in the mess. Was there any information center? Any way to access histories or fiction? Of course not. It would be silly to expect anything like that on a small transport. But Reith noted it anyway, as the first sign of the deprivations he'd no doubt face on the frontier. Probably it was better to go ahead and get his sulking done now, before he made it to Master Jorah and had work to do. Reith still had hopes of changing her mind, but he would rule out that faint possibility before he'd even started if he showed up at Starlight at anything less than his best. So he wasn't in the mood for company. However, he was in the mood to eat, as usual. Growing as fast as he was, 12 centimeters the past year alone, sometimes it seemed as if it were physically impossible to stuff in as much food as he actually needed. To Reith's relief, the vessel's mess was completely silent. He could have privacy and lunch. Under his breath, he muttered, "The best of both... Gah!" At the far end of the mess stood Geode. Had he moved from the cockpit? Had Leox and Affy moved him? Did he walk or crawl or roll or teleport? Reith squinted at the rock, trying to determine whether the being was friendly, irritated, or even awake. Trying and failing. "Sorry," Reith began. You startled me there." Geode made no response. Reith felt silly for expecting one. "Oh, hey," said Affy Hollow as she trooped into the mess. "So, how do you like her? The vessel, I mean." "She's perfect for what we need," Reith admitted. The word perfect made Affy's face light up like a Naboo lantern. "I love this ship. It's my favorite in the whole fleet." "What fleet?" "The Bind Guild," she said, opening up a packet of pale pink powder and tapping it into a small bowl. "Scoverbine is the owner, and she says she's grooming me to help take over someday. If I take on just a little more responsibility, she'll give me a ship of my own. I just know it. And I'd pick the vessel." Reith silently downgraded his thoughts about the size and influence of the Bind Guild. The vessel was serviceable, sure, but if this was the pick of the fleet, he had questions about that fleet. His expression must have betrayed his thoughts too clearly, because Affy laughed. Scover doesn't get why this is my favorite either. But I feel like certain ships, they have an energy, you know? Maybe even a little bit of a soul. The vessel has more of a soul than any other ship I've encountered. And that's what I want to travel the galaxy in.
I understand that, Wreath offered. Maybe the ship grew on you after a while.
It does have, personality. Affy stirred a little water into the bowl, and the pinkish powder puffed up into a sticky bun. So, okay, tell me what the Jedi are in 2 sentences or less.
For the first time in what felt like days, Wreath smiled.
Those 2 sentences might be pretty long. We've got nothing but hyperspace and time.
She settled herself into a chair and took a big bite of the sticky bun, through which she mumbled,
"Ready for this, Geode?"
Geode said nothing and did nothing. Wreath sighed. Best to begin at the absolute beginning.
"Do you know what the Force is?"
Affy gave him a withering look.
"Everybody knows about the Force. Come on."
"All right, all right." He held up his hands in mock surrender.
"Sorry, just making sure. So, the Jedi are Force users, united in our quest to understand the mysteries of the Force, and to serve as guardians of peace and justice throughout the galaxy."
"I've heard of Force users before,"
she said.
"But why does that make you monks?"
"I still have 1 sentence to go. We ground ourselves in a spiritual existence and give up individual attachments in order to focus entirely on greater concerns."
Affy chewed thoughtfully on her sticky bun for a moment before saying,
"So, that means no sex."
Should he give her Master Jorah's whole speech about the difference between celibacy of the body and true purity of the heart? It was a very long speech. Wreath decided to skip it.
"Basically."
She nodded.
"Definitely, monks."
"Now see, that I just don't get," Leox said later when Affy and Geode tried to explain the Jedi to him. "How are you supposed to prove love to the galaxy at large if you don't know how to love any one individual person?"
Affy shrugged as she double-checked their readings. The wavering blue light of hyperspace glinted off every bit of metal in the cockpit, making it look beautifully electrified. Even Geode sparkled slightly. She said,
"You don't have to have sex with someone to love them. You should know that if anyone does."
"Indeed I do. But other beings seem to value copulation as a form of bonding."
Leox then made a face and swore.
"Not appropriate, sorry."
He meant well, she knew, but Affy hated it when he treated her like a kid instead of as an equal. Fortunately, he didn't do that much.
"It's okay. I think I heard of sex once already."
That made Leox laugh.
"Just make sure your mom knows I'm not the first person who talked to you about it."
Every time someone described Scover Bine as Affy's mom, it warmed her through.
"You know, it would be easy to get Scover to like you more. If you just wear the guild coverall once in a while."
"Up with that, I cannot put."
Leox shook his head.
"A man's gotta have standards. And since I lack the financial wherewithal to declare my independence from the guild, my personhood must be asserted sartorially. In other words, you can take my beads from my cold, dead body."
Affy suppressed a smile.
"You know, the Jedi would probably say you were putting too much emphasis on worldly things."
"My relationship to the metaphysical is my own to judge, little bit."
"Don't call me that."
Comac Vitus was a man of reason and logic. While he did not deny he possessed emotions, he never allowed them to cloud his judgment, or so he hoped. His precise mathematical mind preferred the tangible to the nebulous, the quantifiable to the mysterious.
More than one of his fellow Jedi had pointed out that this was an unusual frame of mind for a mystic. However, that was part of what Comac felt he brought to the Order: steadiness and rationality. So why did that mindset now feel less like a gift and more like a defense?
Because you are traveling to the place where you first learn the harm that arises from imprecision, from emotion. All that was born between Irem and Erino. For a moment, he was back in the caverns, Orla shivering at his side, staring in fear at the shapes in the frigid dark. Comac shook his head, as though he could physically rid it of the memory. The best way to get out of the mind was to exercise the body. Options were limited on a ship that size, but a brisk walk through the corridors would do. He made his way through the vessel, hoping for privacy. The hope was in vain, as he almost immediately came across Dez wrapped in conversation with Wreath Silas.
I mean, Wreath was saying, would you call us monks?
Not exactly, Dez said. I see you haven't been able to talk Master Jorah out of the Padawan braid.
No such luck.
Wreath gestured vaguely at the back of his head. In olden days, the braid had been mandatory, at least among apprentices from species that grew hair on their heads. These days, not every master required them. Comac had no intention of doing so, if he ever took another Padawan. Master Jorah Mali clearly felt otherwise. Comac intended to absent himself, but before he drew away, Wreath turned to him.
Excuse me, Master Vitus? May I ask how you go about discovering and recording new legends? As a folklorist, I mean, just find the local wise woman? Ask for a story?
Sometimes.
Comac gazed out of the vessel's very few small windows at the brilliant, eerie blue of hyperspace.
Often it is more complicated. There are always the stories a people want to tell about themselves. And then there are the other stories. The secret ones, the dark ones, the ones whose meanings are more difficult to comprehend. Those aren't the ones they offer to outsiders. Of course, those are generally the most important of all.
They were the stories that would have done the most good between Irem and Erino. Dez grinned as he set about restrapping his boots.
How do you get them to open up about those?
It varies, Comac said. There are species who respect outsiders, who push them hard, demand the facts. There are also species who eat outsiders like that. It's best not to pry until you know which kind of culture you're dealing with. While you're waiting, he shrugged, you study their art. Paintings, tapestries, literature. Symbolism and allegory can reveal a lot. Then you ask about the art, and the legends come up naturally.
Crafty, said Wreath, but also ingenious.
Thank you.
Comac inclined his head.
Dez said, that's got to be a challenge for you, doing something so completely new, to go off the map.
Literally,
Wreath joked. Comac could have said that he'd been to that area of space before, specifically to the lost moon between the twin planets that served as hosts for the new Starlight Beacon. But there was no need to speak of it, and Comac had learned to limit his words. It was far too easy to say too much. In the cockpit of the vessel, Leox Jossi chewed on a spice stick and considered the navicomputer readings. The spice stick was legal in Republic space, for now. Mostly because they hadn't had time to get around to outlawing everything yet. Maybe the sticks would make the cut and remain legal, but maybe not. The Ox had laid away a stash just in case.
Ought to see signs of other traffic, he mused. Clearer signs than this. Are the readouts blurry? If so, why?
Geode, buddy,
Leox said.
You seeing what I'm seeing?
Geode's ominous silence told the whole story. Something was genuinely wrong with hyperspace traffic. Deeply wrong. The few traffic patterns he could make out were moving in directions that didn't make any sense. Leox muttered,
Not liking this. Not liking this at all.
The ship was still moving forward, under no more than the usual stresses, so they might as well keep going. The problem might be local, he figured. Something they'd fly right by. Orla Jareni hoped to spend at least part of their voyage to Starlight Beacon talking with the vessel's crew. She'd be buying a ship of her own soon, something she'd never done before. As much as she'd studied specs and models, she still thought there might be valuable tips to glean from people who spent their whole lives navigating the stars. Some Jedi fell into the trap of thinking that non-Jedi didn't have anything to teach them. Orla, however, always remembered that every single being in the galaxy knew at least one thing she didn't. Affy Hollow seemed the likelier candidate for the conversation, Orla decided, if only because Affy seemed to have a greater commitment to sobriety. Yet Orla found herself putting off the chat. Actually, talking about purchasing her ship would mean talking about her decision to become a Wayseeker. As little as Affy knew about the Jedi, she would surely ask the most obvious question. Why? At the moment, Orla didn't feel confident of her answer. She could simply say instinct. That was true, but unlikely to satisfy Affy's curiosity. It was more likely to pique it. Or she might say,
the Jedi Order and I no longer see eye to eye.
Also true. Also likely to get her into trouble if anybody from the Council ever heard of it. Probably the best answer would be,
I needed to come to know the Force in a deeper, even more meaningful sense.
Also true, and both long and dull enough to discourage further questions.
Wayseeker, her mind had whispered,
and there she was, walking away from the Order to navigate an unknown region of the galaxy all by herself, hoping that out there she would find the purpose her recent missions had lacked.
Am I deluding myself?
She muttered as she stood in the mess making herself some Chandrillan tea.
If I can't find the answers at the temple, what makes me think I'll find them out here? What would my master say if she could see me?
Then she paused, hoping no one had overheard that. Probably not, but on a ship so small, you could never be certain. She resolved to keep her musings internal for the duration of the voyage. Orla took a moment to center herself, but found she couldn't. The energies on the ship were becoming muddled, even frenzied. Orla murmured,
what's happening?
That was when Leox Jossi's voice came over the ship's comms.
Everybody who wants to stay alive, strap yourselves in now!
Wraith ran for the jump seats, reaching them just as all the other Jedi scrambled in. As they hurriedly fastened their safety harness straps, Orla called out,
what's happening?
Leox answered,
near as I can figure, hyperspace is broken.
What?
Dez looked as bewildered as Wraith felt.
How is that possible?
Tons of debris, the kind of thing you usually never find in hyperspace. It's all over hyperspace.
The spice stick gripped between Leox's teeth was getting a grinding.
As in, littering every root out there.
Wraith could barely put the thought into words.
But that would mean a disaster on a galactic scale.
That's pretty much the size of it, Leox said. Now everybody, hang on.
Affy had seen a lot more than most 17-year-olds, had boarded and served as crew on ships traveling the length of the sector, now across the galaxy, all the way from Kenala to Coruscant, had helped steer a ship through a hyperspace vortex once. But she'd never seen Leox Jossi so close to losing his nerve. His hands remained fixed on the controls as he attempted to hold steady.
So, she said, what do we do now?
We try to check whether our path is clear.
Leox would have looked almost relaxed to anyone who didn't know him as well as Affy did. Only she and Geode could detect the tension coiled inside.
If we get hit by so much as a splinter of metal,
We're looking at explosive ejection from hyperspace, followed by your favorite and mine, a hull breach. Hull breach. Every space traveler's worst nightmare. A breach meant being blown out into the frigid void of space, which would kill you within 2 or 3 minutes. Within only seconds, if you had any breath in your lungs, which would immediately expand and burst. Even worse, the electric blue of hyperspace was changing color, shifting more violet all the way to red. Effie had no idea why that was happening, but it couldn't be good. The navicomputer began blinking fast, sending staccato crimson light across the bridge. "We're picking up debris," she managed to report. "Something huge!" Leox said what she was really thinking. "That thing's got a bullseye on us. Can we evade?" "We're gonna find out." Steering in hyperspace was no mean feat. Generally, there was no need to do so, since the navicomputer calculated and modified the jump at inhuman speeds. Today was an exception. Experienced pilots formed a kind of intuition about hyperspace, an instinct that worked better than any droid or machinery. Leox had better instincts than any other pilot Affy had ever encountered. He could save them, if anyone could. She just wished she didn't know how big an if that was.
"Hang on!"
Leox's voice rang through the shuddering vessel. Reith, who was already hanging on as tightly as possible, felt his gut drop. The other Jedi maintained their calm, or seemed to, but Reith could only manage the appearance of it, not the reality. His jittery mind kept talking. "We should have held out for a better ship, or a bigger ship, or a ship with a more credible crew, or basically any other ship except this one." Wham! A bone-shaking jolt struck the ship, jarring Reith so hard he jerked against his safety straps and bit his tongue. Strange vibrations began rippling through the vessel, more ominous than the crash had been. Was their ship about to fall apart? Over the intercom came Leox's voice, lazy as ever.
"Okay, so, there's good news and bad news."
Master Komak and Orla shared a glance, which Reith caught out of the corner of his eye. He wasn't the only one having doubts.
"The good news is that instead of space debris smashing us into so much scrap metal, it only winged us,"
Leox continued.
"The bad news, as the astute among you have already perceived, is that we've taken some damage. Affy's gonna check that out."
Already Affy was dashing past the jump seats, catching herself against the wall every time the ship lurched in a new direction, as it did constantly. Dez said, "Does anyone here have any expertise in StarCraft repairs?" "I just finished the basic course," Reith said, then waited for the other Jedi to chime in with their superior knowledge. Nobody did.
"Your experience is more recent than any of ours, then," Master Komak said. "See if you can help."
He winced as if in pain, but said nothing more. Thinking that he might be the repair expert on board was almost as unnerving to Reith as the collision had been. But he immediately unfastened his straps and followed Affy. The ship lurched from side to side. Reith stumbled into one wall, then another, but managed to stay on his feet until he finally got to the ladder that led below decks. He grabbed the rungs firmly before venturing a foot down.
"What are you waiting for?" Affy called. "Hurry!"
Reith let go of caution and of the ladder, dropping down into the inner workings of the ship. Affy was already hip-deep in machinery, tools in hand. He asked, "What's going on?" Then he saw for himself what was going on, which was that the coaxium regulator had come completely unhitched from its station. Affy had grabbed the regulator with her bare hands, which were already turning blue with a severe cold. Shaking, trembling, she was managing to hold the regulator in place, directing its cool green beam of energy into the engines where it belonged. If she lost her grip, the beam would slide sideways and tear the vessel in two. Affy didn't look up.
"We also need someone to reset the regulator station, if you think you can manage it."
Reith grabbed a tool packet and jumped down into the workings beside her.
I can do it. But if you'd rather I held the regulator while you did the repairs...
No. If the ship lurches during handoff, we're done for.
Affy shivered from the cold, but kept hanging on.
Just be quick about it, okay?
He worked as fast as he could, welding the station frame firmly enough that the worst turbulence shouldn't shake it. The ship continued bucking and shaking, and once Affy seemed on the verge of losing her balance. Reith reached out with the force to steady her as best he could. He didn't have the finesse necessary to hold the regulator exactly in place, but he could keep her upright.
Whoa,
Affy said.
What is that? Is that a third hand or something?
It's the force.
Seriously? You can feel it?
She laughed out loud with surprise and maybe even delight.
You're not a monk. You're a wizard.
Yes, monk wizards, that's us.
Reith checked what he'd done. It looked right, but a more experienced eye was called for.
Are you able to see my work? Do we have it?
Affy glanced over her shoulder.
Yeah, that should do it. Help me lift this.
Reith put his hands on the regulator too and nearly cried out. It was freezing, so much so he could feel stabbing pain in every bone of his arms. Affy had to be in agony. But she did no more than wince as they carefully, carefully pushed it upward. The metallic click of the regulator snapping back into position was one of the best sounds he'd ever heard. Groaning, Affy stumbled back from the machinery. Her hands remained blue, and blisters had formed on her palms.
A stim stabilizer, she gasped. The med pack's in that orange emergency box.
Reith had it before she could finish talking. Quickly, he pressed it to her neck until he heard the hiss-click of medication being dispensed. In only seconds, her hands began to return to their normal color, and the blisters flaked away.
Great, he said. We made it.
We're not out of this yet,
Affy said. Already shaking off the earlier pain, she climbed the ladder.
What do you mean? More repairs?
Wraith looked around for any sign of further damage, but nothing seemed apparent.
Please think about this. Something in hyperspace hit us, and I thought I saw...
Her voice trailed off, and she dashed back toward the bridge.
If we had to get hit, I wish it would have been by anything else. Any damn rock out there in space,
Leox said. No offense.
Geo's amiable silence indicated that none was taken.
Affy hurried back into the cockpit, breathless.
Are we all right?
We are for now. Good job on the repairs, by the way.
The kid monk helped me, but that freighter... Leox... That looked like a fragment of a passenger craft.
Leox sighed, so much for breaking it to her gently.
Yeah, it was.
There would have been hundreds of people aboard, maybe even thousands.
Her face was stricken. Moments like these reminded him how young Affy really was.
Horrible way to die,
Leox agreed. Might as well hit her with all of it up front. Even if she was still a kid, she could handle the truth better than she would any lie.
Listen, I can't be sure, but going over the readouts, that looked a hell of a lot like wreckage of the Legacy Run to me.
Affy's dark eyes widened.
But the Legacy Run is a Bind Guild ship. Sculver travels on it sometimes.
I didn't say it was the Legacy Run. They're similar, maybe not the same, just you ought to brace yourself, all right?
She nodded, already attempting to focus herself back on the matters at hand, despite the febrile reddish light of disturbed hyperspace all around them. His heart went out to her. Not every girl could throw herself into her work when she'd just found out her mama might have died.
Sculver is fine. Sculver is absolutely fine.
Affy repeated this to herself as she settled back into the co-pilot's seat. Scoverbine rarely traveled on guild runs. She preferred to remain on their hub planets, overseeing their fleet in its entirety.
She hadn't mentioned any recent plans to do otherwise, so Affy refused to panic. Even if Scover wasn't on board, and she wasn't, the destruction of the Legacy Run was bad enough. The Republic's arrival in their sector had driven shipping to feverish levels of activity. Everyone wanted to move cargo before it could be taxed, tariffed, or outlawed. Settlers wanted to reach the frontier badly and paid for transport by the thousands every day. Every single ship went out packed with as much living and inert freight as it could possibly contain. Even the vessel had traveled to Coruscant with so many crates of dentabeans that Geode hadn't been able to get through the corridors. Any loss would be a major loss, and the Legacy Run? There would have been hundreds of families aboard, thousands of people, even small children. "The ship's still acting weird," she said, both to snap herself out of worrying and because it was true.
"That's because hyperspace is still acting weird, though now I think it's got more to do with the freighter wreck throwing absolutely everything out of whack. I mean, look at this."
Leox gestured at the readings.
"Debris is flying all over hyperspace. Navicomputer's shutting down lanes faster than we can count them."
He shook his head.
"We're changing course."
Affy went cold as though the coaxium regulator had been dropped back into her arms.
"In hyperspace?"
"Yeah, I know. And don't even start, Geode. Thing is, we gotta drop out of hyperspace as fast as possible. We can't do that and get where we're going. So now, we're going someplace else. Hopefully someplace safe."
She braced herself as preset coordinates began scrolling down the nav screen. Whatever Priest said would get them into real space fastest was their new destination. She'd have to trust that the vessel wouldn't be pre-programmed with coordinates that led to, say, the center of a dwarf star. The final preset clicked in. Leox said,
"Kid Monk back in his jump seat?"
"If not," Affy said, "it's on him. By the way, he's actually a wizard."
Leox raised his eyebrows, as though to say, "Not bad."
"Hang on," he called out over the intercom,
and then they were in real space. No bounce, no jostling, as sweet a re-entry as anybody could hope for. Affy and Leox shared a grin as she called,
"Good pick, Geode.
Now we can figure out what the hell went wrong out there," Leox said. "And then we can get on our way."
Relief washed over Affy as she looked out at the largely empty sector of space surrounding them. They weren't facing hostile ships, or intruding into a war zone, or anywhere near the heart of a star. They were pretty much nowhere. Despite the giddiness of their escape, she couldn't help wondering,
why would the ship be programmed to take us here?
"What happened?" Orla Jareni whispered. Her white face had gone even paler.
"The voices crying out."
"Many have died," Master Comac said. "You felt it too, Wreath?"
Wreath had sensed something was terribly wrong far beyond the vessel itself, and that it was tied to the disaster. But he felt nothing like the kind of shock reflected in both Orla and Master Comac's expressions. It occurred to him for the first time that there might be certain advantages to not being as acutely Force-sensitive as the average Jedi.
"Can you tell us what happened exactly?"
Unsurprisingly, Master Comac pulled himself together first.
"No. We should contact Starlight Beacon immediately. We need more information, and we wouldn't want our delay to cause alarm."
Wreath agreed. Well, mostly he agreed. A small, unworthy part of him wanted Master Jura to feel a little alarm, just enough to make her say,
"You know, the frontier is a needlessly dangerous place for us to be. We should return to Coruscant right away."
Still, he rose and went with Master Comac to the vessel's comm station. It was unlikely that Comac would need help sending their messages, but it was the role of the Padawan to be prepared to offer assistance to any Jedi at any moment. The comm station was a small area with a curved ceiling, hardly big enough for even one adult humanoid. two were already crammed inside, Leox and Affy, the former of whom was holding an amp unit to his ear. Apparently, Geode was alone on the bridge, which Wreath didn't find reassuring. Master Comac knelt at the door as smoothly as though that was what he'd prepared to do all along, and said,
"I realize your ship has urgent communications to make, Captain Jossie, but..."
Leox held up one hand.
"Hang on."
If Master Comac felt impatience, he showed no sign, merely nodded. But Wreath could sense tension building within Leox and Affy, a tension that was catching. He blurted out,
"What's wrong?"
"Everything from the sound of it."
Leox put down the amp unit and flipped a switch, projecting into the room instead. Immediately, they were inundated with noise, more than a dozen signals trying to break through at once, overlapping and blurring one another.
"Lost all power! Stranded in the Bespin system! Signaling any craft within! At least 1,000 souls lost, possibly more! Littered with this stuff, like someone mined hyperspace! Can't even begin to assess the damage until we get through to..."
"What sector are these messages coming from?"
Master Comac asked quietly. Affy's expression was grim.
"All of them."
"So many fragments of the truth,"
Master Comac said.
"No complete picture, which of course is more frightening than the whole truth could ever be."
"We hope,"
Affy retorted. Orla Jareni appeared in the doorway behind Wreath and murmured,
"Any news?"
He whispered back, "It sounds like this is a pretty epic disaster. Many people have already been killed."
Killed. The word was so final, so absolute.
Wreath suddenly felt ashamed to have been unhappy about his frontier assignment, to have been unhappy about his future when so many beings had lost their futures entirely. Then a new transmission came through, louder than the rest.
"All hyperspace lanes should be considered closed until further notice. For travelers beyond the boundaries of the Republic, through to the Outer Rim, we reiterate that hyperspace is currently unnavigable and extremely hazardous. All traffic is advised that hyperspace travel should be avoided at all costs."
"Well, that's that."
Leox shut the transmissions off.
"You heard the lady. Looks like we're sticking around here for a while."
"Where is here?" Wreath asked. Affy replied,
"Pretty much nowhere."
They were in a near-empty corner of space, unable to either move forward or get back home. For now, and for an unknowable amount of time to come, they were stranded.
"Listen," Leox said. "Sure, we can look at this as being marooned in deep space. But when you think about it, it's all just space, really."
Wreath was uncomforted. He went to the bridge, which at least felt potentially useful, and for a moment was alone with Geode, who still stood at the navigator's station. Wreath began.
"Hi. This is terrible, huh?"
"Please,"
Affy whispered as she entered the bridge just after him.
"Don't try to talk to him about it yet. Geode's incredibly sensitive."
"Of course," Wreath said. "But I thought you said he was a wild man?" Leox, who was passing by, interjected.
"His is a capricious nature. One of many moods and climes."
After that, in a fond glance at Geode, he continued on his way. Wreath studied Geode for a few seconds, wondering what exactly he was missing, because it was just a big rock sitting there. Affy settled into the co-pilot's seat, apparently to kill time, but then frowned at a blinking sensor.
"What's that?
Is it more damage to the ship? Something else we need to repair?" Wreath was only beginning to realize how badly he needed something to do to make him feel less helpless. Affy shook her head.
"It's a beacon. A signal beacon. Not an actual message, but an indicator from a ship nearby that needs help."
"Nearby?" Wreath asked. "How near does that mean?"
within this system, reachable by sublight.
Affy said slowly,
"We're not alone. Somebody's out there." "Don't answer,"
Orla called. She'd been walking by the bridge, apparently, but had halted at their words.
"You don't know who's out there."
Her gaze had gone distant.
"You never know."
25 years earlier. Part 1. Padawans Orla Jareni and Comac Vitus were steering the T1 shuttle through hyperspace, and Orla couldn't believe her luck. To judge by the grin on Comac's face, he was equally pleased. It was the role of a Padawan to do whatever task a master required help with. Yes, sometimes this included thrilling acts of heroism, but it could also involve mending ropes or cleaning the floors. Piloting a ship counted as a high-quality assignment, particularly when that meant bringing them closer to another, even more exciting task. Rescuing two kidnapped rulers from the system of Irem and Erino. This system lay far beyond the Republic's borders, in an area that had long resisted Republic membership or help, which the residents labeled interference. While Jedi occasionally traveled into this zone of space, such voyages were rare, and the citizens seemed determined to keep it that way. This was, they proclaimed, independent space. So the fact that these two worlds had called for the Jedi's assistance was hugely promising. A successful mission might finally bridge the gap between this area and the Republic. Master Larrett had pointed out that if these planets were willing to ask for help from within the Republic, the situation was undoubtedly a thorny one. But Orla was undaunted. Probably this hostage crisis could have been resolved by the two worlds working together, something neither planet was willing to do. Irem and Erino occupied a system that served as a waypoint through hyperspace. They held a gateway, one that had long remained closed to the rest of the galaxy. This could have led to immense power for both worlds had they been willing to share it. Instead, they competed for control of the region, belligerently dealing with those who dared to violate their space, each limiting traffic almost to nothing. Irem and Erino weren't actively fighting a war against each other, but intelligence suggested a bitter standoff between the two, one that had lasted for more than a century. Its origins were obscure, and by then beside the point. Irem hated Erino. Erino hated Irem. The end. Until royalty from each planet had been kidnapped and ransomed.
"It is both a great honor and a great opportunity that these people have called to the Jedi for help,"
Master Larrett had said when she briefed Orla on the way to the spaceport.
"We can do more than save these two rulers. We can prevent a war. We may even be able to open another part of the galaxy."
Orla had never had an assignment so significant before. Very few Jedi ever had. She didn't intend to let her master down. Not again. Of late, Orla had been asking too many questions, challenging the decisions of the Jedi Council, only to Master Larrett, of course, but still. At first, Master Larrett had heard her out and even gently debated her, but her patience was being tested.
"To be a Jedi is to serve,"
Master Larrett had said.
"How do you intend to serve if you keep questioning every command?"
The rare rebuke from her master still stung. So this time, Orla would prove how willing she was to serve the Order. She wasn't going to question a single thing. Nobody knew whether the moon had once orbited Irem or Erino, only that it had at some point countless millennia past drifted from its orbit and come to rest in dead space between the two worlds. The moon was so devoid of any value that Irem and Erino didn't even bother fighting over it. It just hung there, obscure and ignored. Which was why almost nobody knew about the caves and tunnels deep within the lunar salt flats, and why the caves were a perfect hideout for those who do not wish to be found. It was the only element of the kidnapping plan that could be called perfect. The rest of it left much to be desired.
Fools!
Isomer growled. The bulky Lasat threw the nearest thing he could reach at his lieutenants. It turned out to be a heavy chair, so they were lucky to dodge it.
How could you kidnap the wrong queen?
At the far end of the cavern huddled two hostages, each bound with metal cuffs, each wearing finery that had been stained and torn during their abduction. Monarch Castle of Arano, a bright blue Pantoran, looked extremely nervous about his situation, which indicated more intelligence than Castle was generally credited with. Next to him sat the tawny-skinned human queen Thandeka of Irem, who looked furious. Isomer could crush most humans without even trying, and Thandeka was a small woman, but he was grateful she had no blaster. One of the lieutenants pointed toward Thandeka, specifically to the silvery coronet woven through her thick black braids.
She wears the crown. The manifest reported the queen was on board. Yes.
Isomer folded his massive arms in front of his chest.
The queen consort was on board. The queen consort is the one who's married to the ruler. On Irem. The ruler is Queen Dima, the Queen Regnant. In other words, the Useful One.
Oh, bosh, said Monarch Castle amiably enough. I'm certain the Queen Regnant wants her consort back. That'll do, won't it, for a leverage?
Under her breath, Thandeka muttered,
What are you playing at? Do you think you can team up with them?
Goodness, no.
Castle seemed appalled at the thought.
But hearing them describe you as useless, it's rather impolite.
You're trying to spare my feelings?
Thandeka looked toward the cave ceiling in what might have been either disbelief or despair.
Trust me. Right now my ego is the least of our problems.
Isomer had ignored all this.
We will discuss it no further,
he said. There would be time to punish these lieutenants and find smarter replacements after this was done. For now, he could only stay the course. The Huts would expect no less. They had approached Isomer as one of the leaders of the Directorate. The mighty Huts had come to him. With the Directorate's greater local knowledge, they explained, he was in a better position to destabilize the local governments. That destabilization would play to the Hutt's long-term advantage, an advantage they would share with those who would help them. Isomer could see it. The Directorate, empowered as partner to the Hutt's, eclipsing every other criminal organization in that part of the galaxy. It was worth more than a little risk.
Lord Isomer!
One of the sensor jockeys called.
A T-1 shuttlecraft has emerged from hyperspace! 70 radii distance.
Isomer's fur stood on end in anticipation. His fanged smile widened as he said,
Call to them from Castle's ship.
The wreckage of that ship lay broken across the planetoid's surface, but his lieutenants had managed to salvage the communications array. At least they got one thing right.
Plead for their help. Lure them in.
Komak pulled himself from a daydream, mentally repeating focus. It hadn't been a bad daydream, just one in which he was dueling brilliantly with his lightsaber, the kind of detailed imagining that could actually improve real performance. But that was a practice for meditation. He had to improve his ability to live wholly in the present, as Master Simix constantly reminded him. At first he thought he'd done well to pull himself from his reverie, but then he realized it had been the comm panel lighting up with an incoming signal. Orla and Komak exchanged glances as the voice came through.
Monarch Castle, in distress, attempted abduction, systems failing.
The code signature of the signal confirmed that it was Castle's ship. Orla responded immediately.
The Jedi are on our way. Hold on.
Should they have double-checked the signal first? That seemed like a minor detail, one Komak didn't dwell upon. He simply steered in the direction of the signal.
So at least one of the hostages got away.
Does that make our mission easier or more complicated?
I guess we'll see, Orla replied.
They exchanged smiles. As different in temperament as they were, Comac always turning within, Orla always leaping ahead, they'd been friendly since the creche and were equally eager to begin their mission in earnest.
Within moments, some sort of planetoid appeared in the distance, one so small and remote it didn't even have a name.
Comac punched in the shuttle's approach vectors without a second thought. Then Master Laird hurried onto the bridge. She, like Master Simix, had been deep in meditative trance. Comac had expected to go rouse them both, but something had brought Master Laird to awareness, and then to alarm.
"What's happening?"
she said.
"Monarch Castle must have escaped," Orla began. "We got a confirmed signal from his ship."
"From his ship?"
Master Laird said grimly.
"Not from Monarch Castle."
Comac and Orla exchanged uncertain glances. Too late, Comac felt a shiver in the Force, the eerie dissonance that meant not all was as it seemed. And then outer space itself seemed to blaze with light, and the ship shook and twisted, and there was no up or down anymore. No way to stop. No way out.
Well, tickle my pickles and call me a cucumber. Part 2 of Into the Dark took us to new heights. We faced down challenges and dived deep into the heart of the hero's journey. From unclear ethics to saber-swinging showdowns, we've journeyed through the galaxy of marvels and mysteries, each more intriguing than the last. And I think this is the perfect time for the quote. It's flying our way from Alexander Gifford. He said, "The road to achievement is paved with persistence, not shortcuts." Okay, what does that mean? Let's imagine you're on a road trip to Achievement City. The city represents a big goal that you got, like landing your dream job, mastering a new hobby, or saving up for something big. Now, the road to get there isn't a straight, fast highway. It's more like a winding path with lots of hills and sometimes a bit of rough weather. So when he says the road to achievement is paved with persistence, not shortcuts, that's what he's talking about. Think about it like this. If you try to find a quick and easy way to get to Achievement City, like shortcuts through the woods, you might end up lost, stuck, or even further away from where you started. But if you stick to the path, keep pushing through the tough parts, and don't give up, even when it feels slow and hard, you'll make it to your destination. In real life, this means you are working towards something important to you. Shortcuts might seem tempting, but it doesn't really work like that. You gotta put in the time. Persistence is about showing up, doing the work, and moving forward, step by step, even on the days when it feels like you're not getting anywhere. It's that steady effort and determination that will get you to Achievement City. Celebrate your big wins, because you chose the path of persistence, not shortcuts. And that's a wrap for Episode 2. We hope you love diving into Part 2 of Into the Dark with me, and I can't wait to have you on board for Part 3, coming your way in just a few days. So until then, may the Force be with you. Thank you for listening to Star Wars Audio Archives. Join us next time for more Star Wars adventures. If you would like to listen to other episodes of the show, you can follow us on your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoyed the show, we would greatly appreciate a 5-star review. Once again, thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you. Sway was created by Keen Eye Shed and is a production of Pick Film Media. This show was produced by Quinn McDaniel and was distributed by Sway Cast Network. Star Wars was read to you by Jason Odega. Sound designed by Theodore Thompson. I am your host, Kyle, and we will see you next time in a galaxy far, far away.